This is a Dreamcast disc and is for use only on a Dreamcast unit. Playing this disc on a hi-fi or other audio equipment can cause serious damage to its speakers.
Dreamcast, up to 6 billion players.
Welcome back to the Stage of History.
Why don't we play together?
Hey, it's time to make some crazy money. Are you ready? Here we go!
Please stop this disc now.
Hello, and welcome to episode 13 of the Dreamcast Junkyard Dream Pod. My name is Rob, and I'll be your host for today's super show. Joining me to talk about a multitude of Dreamcast-related content, we have an elite team of experts drawn from not one or two, but three different continents. So, sitting approximately 10,000 miles away from me, on my left, somewhere, is Scott. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Rob.
Next, sitting about 4,000 miles away from me, on my right, is Caleb. Hi, Caleb.
Greetings from Northern America.
And finally, sitting only a paltry 145 miles away from me to the south, is Tom. Hi, Tom.
Good afternoon. Good evening. Good That's morning.
What a nice British hello that was.
I was expecting a proper like good day from Scott there. I was a bit disappointed to be
honest.
Scott, can I just ask you a question? I'd be very disappointed if there's not at least one barbecue with a shrimp on it within eyeshot.
I'm sorry. Yes, you are. You will be disappointed. Yes, I'm sorry about that.
God damn it.
Everything I know about Australia is just been turned upside down.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, cool. Well, it's good to have you guys with me tonight. So let's get started, shall we? Gentlemen, we're going to start this pod as we always do, talking about what we've been playing or what we've just picked up. So let's start with Tom. What have you been playing, Tom?
I mean, we've been away now for a couple of weeks, so it's given me a bit of time to actually make some purchases. Yeah, well, I've made a couple. The first one I want to talk about is Virtua Cop 2, which is a direct port of the Saturn game, even though I believe it's based on the PC version.
Okay.
I'd heard before I got it that it wasn't compatible with the PAL light gun, and when I first played it, I plugged it in with my VGA set up, you know, on the VGA CRT monitor, and lo and behold, it didn't work. The light gun wouldn't register on the screen. But then I just happened to put it into the Dreamcast connected to a TV, and just thought I'd try my luck with the light gun, and it worked perfectly. So I can confirm that the Japanese version of Virtua Cop 2 does work with the PAL light gun if you use a traditional CRT TV.
Boom! Exclusive. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I read that on. Yeah, I've read that in a couple of forums that it doesn't work with any guns other than the Japanese one. And lo and behold, it worked fine with my PAL one. So, and it was actually in a PAL machine as well, just using a boot disk.
Oh, I didn't know anything about there being reading anything about it not working with the PAL gun. I just assumed it did, and then I saw on the Facebook page that you were originally saying that it was incompatible, and I thought, oh, that means I've got to go buy a Japanese gun now.
That's the initial reason why I held off from buying it, because I'd read somewhere that it wasn't compatible with anything but a Japanese gun, which made me a bit like dubious, because I was always under the impression that guns are sort of universal, the same as all the different peripherals.
So was I, to be honest. I mean, like, we've talked quite a bit about this over the past couple of pods, and I'm amazed, really, sort of, like, what sort of misadventures you can get up to in light gun land. I'd always presume, just like you just said, that you buy a light gun, it works anywhere. But that's not the case. So, just to confirm with this, it was the Japanese version of Virtua Cop 2 in a PAL machine with a PAL gun on but it didn't work on the...
It didn't work on the VGA PC monitor, so the CRT monitor.
Yeah.
Worked on a normal CRT TV.
Yeah, cool.
That's weird. Strange.
Yeah.
Apart from Virtua Cop 2, I've been playing a little bit of Grandia 2 as well. People who listen to the podcast regularly in the past might know that I'm not familiar. Well, I'm not much of an RPG fan, but I thought, I'm going to play this. The Steam release happened today, I believe, or yesterday. And I thought, you know, a lot of people quite like this game. So why not give it a go? And I have to say, I'm absolutely loving it. It's fantastic. I don't like RPG games as a rule. and I'm really into Grandia too. So
yeah, I was reading that people have been porting their Dreamcast saves to the Steam version and being able to use them, and also backporting progress in the Steam version back into the Dreamcast version, which I thought was interesting. And
yeah,
I believe
I believe that the Steam version is actually based on the Dreamcast version, so it's got a lot of the same code. So that's why it will understand the save files from the VMU.
Yeah, it gives me hope that Yu Suzuki will think about that for Shenmue 3, but that's probably a very tall hope.
Oh yeah, can you imagine bringing in your save from like Shenmue 2?
Yeah,
that'd be amazing.
Yeah. Just make sure that the save file for Shenmue 3 in the same format as what would have been on the VMU. But I don't know whether that's possible or not.
To be honest, I'm sure Yu Suzuki listens to this podcast regularly.
So,
So you, if you are listening, please, apart from Grandia 2 and Virtua Cop 2, I also got a baseball game. Is it Power Pro Baseball? The super deformed Japanese baseball game. I have to admit, I've not actually played that yet, but I've picked it up. I've got that waiting to be played. And apart from that, on the Dreamcast, that's me.
Awesome. Okay, Caleb, what have you been playing?
Well, thank you, Rob. Yes, I would love to talk about what I am playing, but unfortunately, I can't, because it's a secret, because I may or may not be releasing a new review video soon on YouTube. But I will, however, tell you about some amazing pickups that I got. I'll save one, but the one, I just went to a random garage sale, and they had a brand new in-package Dreamcast VMU, just randomly for sale. So I picked up that and like a sealed NES game and some other things. And apparently they bought a building that was a toy store at one point in time, and somebody had apparently been hiding this Dreamcast stuff behind the behind one of the cashier registers.
Wow.
So they just kind of looked at it and they found a little hidden cache of stuff.
Wow. Awesome.
That's like the dream, isn't it? The dream come true. Like, oh, we've got all this stuff in the back. It's all mint condition. You're like, you got rares.
I know.
You got rares. You got Project Justice. You're like, yeah, they're like a dollar each. Like, oh.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, I was just going to add to what Caleb was saying about the brand new VMU. If you're planning on opening that up, hang on to the little plastic tab that separates the battery from the connection, because they're really useful. It's like, and a lot
they're very useful.
Yeah, people throw them out, but you need to keep them.
Yeah, no, back in 2009, I bought like a used black controller that still had its little thing in there.
Yeah, yeah.
And I pulled it out, and the batteries were still good.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it completely stops the batteries from getting drained, because it cuts off the thing.
Because when you guys were talking about in the last time I was on the episode about how the VMU runs out of battery really quickly, I was thinking back going, well, I used to play like VMU Tetris and VMU Pac-Man waiting for the bus, and I don't remember changing the batteries that often. And it's because I kept that little plastic tab so that I would play it and use a little bit of the battery drain and then put the plastic tab back in when I wasn't using it. And then when I used it again next time, pull the plastic tab out, and then the battery lasts a lot longer. Yeah.
Very skillful, that, yeah. Does it not take a little bit of like of a technique to actually put it back in? Or
yeah, it is a little bit fiddly. And if you don't have it anymore, like any sort of non-conductive material would work. But yeah, it's just
like peanut butter, like just shoved in, like yeah.
Well, no, something less sticky.
Yeah,
but yeah, I was going to do a sort of a mini article about VMU tips. So that was going to be one of them for the Dreamcast main page. So yeah, so there's a. Early exclusive there for that article. Hang on.
Speaking of, maybe throw in like tips for. Were you going to talk about like cleaning stuff off that sort of plastic? Because what a lot of people do is they use permanent markers.
Oh,
so
yeah.
So a bunch of mine have permanent marker stains.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, I'll tell you, if you're absolutely. You need to get stuff off that, the plastic, and it's permanent marker. The one thing you can try as a last resort is Lest Oil. And I don't know what they call it in other countries, but Lest Oil is like just super powerful concentrated floor cleaner. And just a little bit of that, like carefully applied, will generally take off even like Super Sharpie or whatever is used to on there. But right. You got to watch out because it's very, 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 very powerful.
Yeah, I remember using it was like an orange-based solvent on the front of a Dreamcast PAL case to remove the sticky label, and that turned out to be a mistake because it kind of just started melting the plastic. So,
it's like acid or something.
No, it was just a really powerful solvent, so that it just smeared, and then the smear didn't go away. So that was a mistake. But yeah.
The stuff they sell in America, I don't know what they call it there. It's called Goo Gone here, and that's actually orange-based as well. But that actually is good because it won't damage anything.
Yeah.
If you're just putting it on bare plastic, it's good for getting stuff off, and it won't actually damage the plastic.
Yeah, the one I used was Big Kev's Orange Cleaner or something, and I don't think it's around anymore. So yeah.
Okay, so we'll now move on to what Scott's been playing.
Yeah, I was thinking this is a bit awkward because then Rob gets left, but yeah, I'll just continue. So I've got most of my time has actually been spent with Sega's first console instead of Sega's last console, so I'm sort of letting the side down here a bit because I've been determined in my spare time to work through my folder of raw scans of my SG-1000 collection for the Sega Retro site. So I've been spending a lot of time doing that because only this year I recently completed my collection with the full set of Australian cartridges and then the Japanese releases that weren't released in Australia. So I've got the full complete set of at least one regional variation. But then recently on eBay, I was tempted by some European regional variations that turned up for $30 each, and I said to myself, I'm not going to go for the full set of all regional variations, but these were too tempting, so I've picked up a few of those.
So are you in the process now of kind of scanning them all and then putting them onto Sega Retro? Yeah.
So I've done the raw scans of all of them, and then I've been spending my spare time just like cropping them and rotating them to be at right angles and things. So. So I spent a lot of my spare time.
Just want to say for those people who are listening who are not familiar with Sega Retro, that's kind of like a Wikipedia, isn't it, for Sega hardware and software. And if you go to SegaRetro.org, you'll find this massive like cave of knowledge and information on the most random things.
Yeah, the idea was to document everything Sega related, which has turned into a bit of a headache because Sega-related stuff branches out into lots of different avenues that are difficult to document, like the Sega Toys range. And there was not only the karaoke add-on for the Dreamcast, but a whole range of Sega-branded karaoke machines that are also poorly documented. And once you start going down the rabbit hole, it starts leading into many different directions.
An entire warren of rabbit holes in different
that's
directions.
Right. Yeah. So there's been many contributors to the Sega Retro Wiki trying to sort of get a control of that. So it's a big project. But one of the major aspects at the moment is just getting a page up for every game that they released and then scans of the box art for every game. So it's not just the stuff I've been focusing on from the SG-1000, but there's a plan.
No, I mean... Yeah. I must say I've used it many, many a time myself when I've been researching for articles and things. So it's a great project and great resource for people who maybe
Sega. Yeah.
Yeah. I sometimes wonder with it's a really impressive resource. And I sometimes think with the work that guys are doing like with Sega Retro, but with many different types of site like this that, in 50, 75 years' time, how important they'll be in chronicling this sort of early age of video gaming. Because, do you know what I mean? Mm. I feel like unless someone puts in the legwork now, then, no one else is going to do it, are they? And you'll get to that period where 70 years down the road, it's like when we look back now and we go, oh, if only somebody had written this down or had taken pictures of this, from 70 years ago in our time, and we don't have access to that information. And it's going to be, I think it's going to be, thanks to sites like this, that in video gaming we do.
Yeah, and if there's any obsessive compulsive Dreamcast collectors out there that have a lot of spare time on their hands, if you want to start scanning in your box art and particularly the European PAL manuals, which are like 150-odd pages long, if you have an interest in contributing, we would like, you know, PDF scans of all 150 pages, which is, you know, a tall ask, but it'd be nice to have those documented for future generations. But yeah, they are very fiddly to scan. I can attest to not enjoying it very much myself, but yeah.
So get scanning, people. Get scanning. Rob, so, last but not least, sorry, Scott, have you been doing anything else other than the SG?
I picked up the Dreamcast copy of Alan Saar and Philia Conversion that came out recently. I must admit. I haven't had a chance to play it, but I was interested in reading the back of the box. It said that the discs were not only compatible with Dreamcast, but also compatible with Windows, Macintosh, and Linux as well. I haven't tested that out, and like, so shame on me, because I could just chuck it in my computer and see if it works. But I thought that was a really interesting idea for potentially future Dreamcast releases. That, you know, if your Dreamcast is out of commission for whatever reason, you can still play the game on PC or something. But yeah, that was a really interesting. I've never seen that before in any homebrew release for Dreamcast before, which I thought was interesting.
I almost thought you were going to say then that it was also going to be compatible with the Jaguar CD, because those games came out on the Jag first, didn't they?
Yeah, yeah.
So that would have been cool.
Yeah, yeah. So that was interesting. And yeah, and I've been getting various components for my Lindbergh project as well, which I've been posting on the Facebook page, and I won't get into too much detail about it here, just sort of doing some case mods and installing a power supply unit. So that was cool. So yeah, and I also picked up, this is turning into the SG-1000 junkyard, but I also picked up an SF-7000 floppy disk add-on for the SC-3000 Sega computer. So it's a bit like how the Mega CD add-on added CD support to the Mega Drive, the SF-7000 add-on for the SC-3000 added floppy disk support for the Sega, for the very first Sega computer.
Hey, I just had a quick question about this. I don't know anything about magnetic media like that. Like, I mean, how long is a floppy disk going to last, like physically?
There is a time limit on, you know, how long these things will last. And I've purchased 4 SF-7000s over the years, and I've yet to get one to work. And they're very rare and quite reasonably expensive, so I've probably got like one of the largest concentrations of SF-7000 machines, but not one of them have worked yet. So I don't even know whether the disks that I have are still functioning. But yeah, it's a big problem with the cassette releases that came out for the SC-3000 as well, because they're all like magnetic cassette tapes, which are starting to degrade now too. Like, many of the copies that I've bought no longer function. There's a digital preservation project trying to get those saved for future generations as well. But we're sort of running out of time for a lot of them as well. So,
yeah, I mean, here's the thing too: we need to like really thank the individuals and the companies that are actually taking steps to preserve like older video games. And, you know, let's not be so quick to like, you know, thank some of the corporations who are selling retro games now, who in the past have like destroyed more retro video games than any other country in the world. Let's not just like automatically give them kudos just because they're trying to make some money off this. Let's thank the people who are actually interested in preservation at what it comes to video games. Please and thank you.
I totally second what you've just said there, Caleb. I mean, I used to work in digital preservation for the National Archives in the UK, so I'm quite sort of au fait with what you're saying, and it's a big problem. You know, there's things like disk rot and deterioration of media and obsolescence that are quite important. And what you're doing, Scott, is quite commendable.
I was planning on once I finished documenting my collection and I end up, you know, dead in the future, I was going to leave my collection to the Australian National Sound and a Film Archive. So, yeah, it's interesting that you worked on the UK version of that as well. Yeah, it's cool.
On that happy bomb, should we ask Rob what he's been playing?
Not much, but I have actually been playing some stuff on Dreamcast. Yeah, I posted just a couple of days ago on the Dreamcast Junkyard a crazy speed run of Ikaruga done by Tazbot.
That was awesome.
Which was awesome, wasn't it? I mean, it was just insane. Of course, watching the beauty of that run then made, oh, well, I'll stick it in. You know, like, it's sort of, you lie to yourself when you watch it and you go like, yeah, I can remember that. Yeah, I do that. I can do that small 5-second bit like that. Off you go, and I go and do it. And yeah, damn, I'm not as good as the machine playing Ikaruga. Yeah. But what a game. So I've played some more of that. And the only other thing I played is something that I stick in like most weeks, really. It's Net the Tennis, which is this silly little Japanese exclusive tennis game that was released like really early doors. And it was, again, like Choo Choo Rocket. It's really, really basic, simple game. The graphics are really cartoony. It could almost have come out on the Saturn. Maybe it could have come out on the Saturn. But the big thing was it had net play. But it sort of got this nice, not too complicated, you know, tennis mechanic. The physics aren't too complicated. It's nice to just put in and have a quick bash on. So, yeah, that's the other game I've been playing. But that's it, really.
Yeah, I'll have to have a look into that. I don't think I've got that one. That sounds interesting.
Net the Tennis. It's got it's a crazy woman and a random dog on the front.
Right, okay.
The dog, it's got no real bearing on gameplay or anything, but typical sort of Japanese title. Okay, cool. Is there anything else anyone wants to talk about now about what they've been playing or buying?
Yeah, I'll just add, this will lead into a bit of a rant, but it's I think more so with the Dreamcast than any other system, as you're collecting games for it, you eventually come to a point where you can no longer get the things that you're after locally, particularly because there are many different exclusive games released in regions outside of where you live. And it was particularly bad for me in Australia because the Dreamcast was a complete and utter failure, and there's very limited games that you'll find in the wild here. So most of my collection has been sourced from international sellers. And so once you get into that sort of sphere, you're at the mercy of your local post office and custom. Just quickly mention, but I've got a main point that I'm getting to. I pre-ordered the very first version of Ux from Hughcast, and there was a regular and a limited edition and a special limited edition with a poster and all these other goodies, and it just never turned up. I never saw it. Renee at Hughcast was very good to me because this was when they were first starting, and he sent me another copy of the limited edition, but I lost the poster and stuff. And I think found out later that the postman had just left it on the front door of the units, and some bugger had just walked off with it, which really annoyed me. And another time I ordered the House of the Dead 2 PAL set with the gun from overseas. And as it entered, yep, it entered Australian shores, customs officials have read the document and says, gun. And so it got sliced open with a box cutter, and the outer box and the everything was ruined, and I was very annoyed about that as well. But besides those horror stories, I feel like there is a lot of pain in waiting for things from overseas to arrive home, particularly when you pre-order a brand new homebrew game or independent developed game, and you can wait. And I don't mind waiting, but you've got to wait like 18 months or a couple of years before it's ready. And the address you provide at the time that you order it may not be the address that you're living at 2 years down the track. So there's a maintenance of, you know, where you get things delivered to. And I think this is sort of relatively unique to Dreamcast collectors. And I was wondering whether you guys have a similar experience. And I thought I found a solution, but then this will flow on to my rant. So do you guys have a similar experience collecting Dreamcast games from overseas, that it's difficult to ensure that it's delivered to you, or there'll be some other problem or something? Any horror stories to share?
My own experience is that because Dreamcast games are quite sort of abundant online here in the UK, I've never really had to order things from overseas. I mean, I've ordered a couple of things from Japan, but they do say, like, for example, on eBay, that it might take, you know, 2 to 3 weeks to be delivered. And in those instances, they've turned up, and can't say I've had any real problems. Don't know about you, Rob or Caleb.
Not so much for Dreamcast. I think I agree with you, Tom. Just there seems to be, I mean, I've got some Japanese stuff, and I've bought a couple of Dreamcast games literally from Japan and sent it over. And yeah, but nothing's ever gone wrong. The most sort of like heart and mouth moment I think I've ever had, I was I'm really into my Neo Geo, and I was ordering something through the Neo store, which was a quite expensive converter, which converted MVS carts to play on an AES system.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, which is, you know, there's quite a lot of engineering that needs to go into the cart. It's not a simple thing. And they supply you tracking for some of these things. I remember watching the tracking. I was watching for like a week and a half as it was getting prepared. Neo Store's based in the US. I'm watching it, and then it's like, oh, now it's left. Now it's gone through US customs, and now it's left. And now it's in Switzerland. What? Oh, that's fine. It must just be stopping off at Switzerland on its way to the UK. Wait a minute. It's telling me it's out for delivery in this random town in Switzerland. And like, I've spent quite a lot of money on this converter. I'm not going to say how much, but I was like a heart in mouth, you know, situation. And in the end, I got it all sorted out. It didn't cost me anything. It cost the poor chap who ran the Neo store quite a lot, because the Swiss authorities say a bit similar to what you said, Scott, with the gun, that they ripped it all open to see what it was, because they didn't believe whatever he'd written on the customs paper. And so then they knew exactly how much it cost. And so then they were like, well, we're not going to let this out unless you pay X amount of money.
Yeah.
And he'd also sent, the problem was, he'd sent my item to this chap in Switzerland, and this chap in Switzerland had also bought some very rare AES boxed cart from the Neo store, and that had gone to some other country.
No.
So it was this nightmare of like, and it took about a month. Look, I want to say, if anyone's listening to this, the chap who runs the Neo store is a super chap, and I've bought many things from the Neo store. This is the only one time it's happened. It just, you know, it's just when you know what I mean, when you spend quite a bit of money and you're waiting for about 6 weeks, you know, and you don't know what's going to go on, you don't know if it's ever going to be delivered, you know.
Was the other guy in Switzerland also called Rob Jones, or?
No, not at all. He literally, you know, the
Swiss version of me.
The Swiss version, he's just got, I don't know, he's got a moustache and I don't know. I don't know what they do in Switzerland.
There's an umlaut above the O. It's, yeah.
That's the only difference, yeah. But no, I wouldn't say really. I think the waiting game is the hardest. And I think I've come to learn as well when I'm importing. Like, I don't know what it's like in Australia or the US, but like with software, if I order a game from Japan, there's no customs charge. But or for other items, if you order a console, or, you know, I don't know, if you bought a Japanese Neo Geo Pocket Color or something, that would certainly get taxed. And often you get taxed through the teeth upon entry, which can be quite annoying.
Yeah, I had a similar experience. I'll let Caleb talk.
No, I've been very lucky with the stuff that I got from Japan, and the one time that I got something from the UK that I paid for, you know, it does that thing where you open up the game and literally there's just like a tinkle because like the game has been bashed up, that all the little teeth that hold the CD in place are just all broken and just falls apart.
I can agree with that.
It's real bad.
Yeah, as far as customs charges, I don't generally have an issue getting stuff into Australia if it's below $1,000. But I once ordered, there's a very rare Mega LD Laserdisc release for the sort of Mega Drive era for MIST. There was a MIST conversion that was never fully released, but there's like about a dozen beta discs out there. And I paid over $1,000 for it to ship it to her.
What?
Yeah,
wow.
Well,
MIST. I've just realized.
Tom,
what he was saying.
Tom, it's not MIST. It's a beta of an unfinished game. That's a MIST port. Pay attention.
Silly me.
Only 12 of them. Only 12 of them, Tom. Come on.
This will start. This will. There's a beta version 110 or 111, and then there's a beta version 112. And I bought the 111, which is about a dozen, for $2,500 Australian, and then a week later,
do you know what it is?
A week later, the even rarer number 12 version came out and there's only about three of those in the world, and that was like another $2,500. So in for a pit. In for a penny, in for a pound. Should I just?
Right. Now, what I want to happen, I want him to go to his mail. I want him to open up this package and just have like a CDR where somebody just sloppily wrote "missed beta" on it. That's what I want
once,
to happen.
Once you
at
start
this point.
Committing to Mega LD Laserdisc releases, you do have to expect that the games are going to be very, very expensive.
Oh my lord!
And I committed to it, and I got almost a complete collection, and I don't even have any of them in my possession at the moment because I've sent them to a friend in Sydney who's working on digitally preserving them, and he's got...
I hope he's a good friend.
I hope he is too. It's like, you know, the price of a small car in you know, ancient laser disc technology. But I'm sorry,
Scott. The dog got in him, and just, you know, he ate all of them pretty much.
But yeah, I was reading the customs form to try and determine what the duty would be for importing a laser disc, and it's obviously not listed because they don't exist anymore. But I trailed through it and got to like optical disc media. No customs charge, and I went, oh, you beauty, I don't have to pay any extra. But no, as it entered the country, someone decided that, you know, it doesn't fall under that category, it falls under another category, so there was another like $700 or $800 before they would even send it to me. And it was really annoying because I feel like the point of customs
Whoa.
Is to
there's just but it wasn't I mean that's like That's almost like a half or a
yeah,
third of
yeah.
its worth.
My credit card was very unhealthy for a long time there.
Don't you wow. don't you have like weird rules in Australia where you're not allowed to bring like any soil or fruit or stuff like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, so that's what I was getting. Yeah, the customs are about sort of protecting that sort of stuff, and the charges are to discourage you buying internationally and encourage you buying locally. But in this particular case, I can't buy a rare missed laser disc locally. I can only get it overseas.
Well, no.
So making me pay extra to get it doesn't discourage me from buying things overseas because I can't get it here. So that really annoyed me at the time. But the second version that I ordered, I'd said on the customs form, say that it's $999 and then it'll slip under the threshold for additional duty. So I learned that pretty quickly. So yeah.
In a similar but not the same kind of way, when I was sending out the Dreamcast collection vinyl to the winner of the second competition, the woman at the post office was like, "Oh, is it worth anything?" I was like, "Well, what's the difference in price if it is?" And she went, "Well, if you send it normal post, it's like £5 something, but if it's worth more than £100, it's like 12 something." And I looked at how much money I had in my pocket. I had about £6, but I also wanted to get a sandwich because it was like my lunch hour.
Yeah,
I was like, yeah, I'm just going to send it normal post. Yeah.
Come on. Don't eat $2 sandwiches. Come on.
I had Rob reminded me of another similar situation where I was watching the tracking of a aggregated parcel of Japanese stuff from a proxy seller in Japan sending me like a giant sort of 20-kilo box of stuff. And watching the tracking, and it came like Japan, Sydney, into Canberra where I live. Sort of hung around Canberra for a day, back to Sydney, and then I thought, "Hang on, but like, why is it coming to my door? Why is it going back to Sydney?" And I thought, "Is it being returned to sender? Is it about to get on a plane back to Japan?" So I got on the post office and tracked it down, and. Someone along the way decided that there was a terrorism threat around my box, and it needed to go back to the facility in Sydney where you know, terrorist-style detection facilities and quarantine to see whether there was some kind of, you know, bomb or something inside it. So that's why it did this weird sort of track to almost here and then away from here. So that was quite annoying. But apart from all of these issues, the main point I was getting to was a solution to my problem was to get stuff delivered to my work address and not my home address, because
Yeah, that's what I used to do when I worked at the TV station. I got everything addressed to the TV station.
If you want someone to ring you during the day, you give them your work number. And if you want something delivered to you during the day, you give it delivered to where you are during the day, rather than attempting to deliver it them at home when you're not home and then leaving a card for you to pick it up later or something. So that's what I did to avoid a lot of these problems. And it was working great for like 5 years. I was on a first name basis with the guys in the mail room, and they were dealing with my big 20 kilo boxes from Japan, and everything was fine. And then recently, at the beginning of July, we got an email from the Peer Solar chaps who were set out final notice, update your address. This is the last chance you've got to update your address before we send out Peer Solar for Dreamcast. And I was one of the people that put the money up for the expensive I Am the Boss edition. So I'm one of the six people that there's a character in the game that represents me as a hidden boss in the game somewhere.
So, oh, nice.
This is actually the second time I've featured in a Dreamcast game. So I'm in Peer Solar, and I'm also in Wind and Water Puzzle Battles. Awesome. So I've got two games under my belt now. So if there's any independent developers out there that need an additional character, I'll go for the hat trick.
But, yeah, Falco, I know you're listening. Listen, Falco. With all the goddamn coverage we've given your game throughout like a goddamn decade, you put Scott in your game, Falco. We've talked about your game a lot in the Junkyard. Come on, do the right thing.
That would be awesome. And I was tempted to get into Shenmue 3 as well, but it was a little bit out of my price range. But yeah, I'm around. if you're looking for me, I'm around in some of the games you might have. But anyway,
I think what would be good if in Elysian Shadows, like one of the final bosses was like all of us from the Junkyard.
That's so awesome that game is finally getting made, because I remember like writing articles about Elysium Shadow like back in 2009. It's like crazy.
That would be great. So I confirmed my address for this release as my work address. And then 7 days later at work, I go down to pick up some stuff, and I'm told by the guys in the mailroom that there's been cuts to the support staff in the mailroom, and they're no longer accepting personal mail delivery to work. And they suggested I get stuff sent to the front desk instead and pick it up from there. And I thought, oh, yeah, that's cool. I can update and deal with that. But then I received an email from Human Resources that said, if you have 14 days to comply with no longer getting personal mail delivered to work, if anything arrives after those 14 days, we will open it, determine whether it's work-related or not. If it's not work-related, we will return it to sender and say, this has been sent to the wrong address.
And
that really got my back up, and I started doing research, and I sent this email back saying, like, number one, an address is a public domain asset. Like, whether it's a business address or a residential address, you do not have proprietary control over that address, so anyone can use it. And once a parcel has been created to Apeson at an address, there is a duty of care to ensure that that parcel gets to the rightful owner. And interfering with that process or opening it without permission are actually criminal offenses that are like with fines of like $10,000 or 5 years imprisonment. So I detailed this in an email response back to Human Resources, saying that they had no right to enforce this. And the original guy said, you made a good point, I'll pass it up the line. And then several days later, I get an email back saying, How dare you contradict our authority, and how dare you use the law against our policy is above the law. How dare you suggest these things? And like, at this stage, like, I'm waiting on my Peer Solar package, my particularly unique I Am the Boss edition, and I'm thinking, if this arrives and they open it up and then decide it's not work related and send it back, I'm going to be really pissed off. So there was this big fight between me and Human Resources, and I got the union involved, and it was a big brouhaha. And eventually,
well, it's the thing that bugs me. It's like, it's not like you did this before the rule happened.
No, that's
like,
right.
You know, yeah. It's just like this. This is like, it's common to do something like way before. It's not like you're saying you always want this to happen. It's just like, well, you ordered this thing before the rule existed.
That's right.
So,
yeah.
I mean, it's just, it's going to be one more thing and that's it. Like, I don't.
Yeah. So I whittled them down to a deadline of the 31st of August, and then anything I'm still waiting on beyond that, I need to tell them. So it's sort of okay now, but like, it just really annoyed me at the time. And it's, and like, if you ordered something from overseas and chose like surface mail or sea freight, that can take like 2 to 3 months. So like this 14 day window was just insufficient. And I'd also ordered stuff for my sister's birthday that was saying it'd be like 2 to 4 weeks or something. And it was this sort of hard line, you know, all of a sudden we're changing the policy and you've got this tiny window to comply. It just really got me going.
You've got to take the fight to the Piazzola guys and tell them, you know. Deliver it on a certain day at a certain time.
Yeah, I did
get back
to them and said, can I change the address? And Watermelon are currently sort of moving offices and stuff. And they said, we can't change the address, unfortunately. So it's still going to be delivered to work. And I need to sort of smooth over things with the guys in the mailroom to, like, please don't ruin my Piazzola delivery. So
at this point in time a well-placed $20 bill in the hands of some of the in hands of some of the mail workers, that's gonna be your best bet at this point, I think.
I think so. So I'm still really annoyed because I think I'm right and they don't have the
you're,
right to
you're
enforce.
Obviously right, like, yeah, I don't understand business decisions like that always come from somebody who I don't understand. Yeah, it's just corporate culture, I guess.
So if anyone's out there getting, you know, if anyone's out there ordering Dreamcast stuff to work, you've got some knowledge armed on how to fight it if they say they can't. But, you know, just be warned and do what you can to me.
Fight the good fight. All right, gents, we're going to move on, and we're going to move on straight away to the news section. I don't know if you guys know this, but Dreamcast sales are on the up dramatically. What do we think of this? Is this the retro bandwagon finally catching up with our beloved Dreamcast, or is this good news? Discuss. Tom.
Yeah, if anyone, people listening to this, and also yourself, Scott, and Caleb, basically, there's a an industry, like, new, it used to be a magazine, but now it's a website called MCV, who basically report on the news from the industry, and they've put out a story this week that used sales of the Dreamcast have basically increased exponentially since the announcement of Shenmue 3. And we covered this on the main site on the Dreamcast Junkyard this week. Part of me thinks it's a good thing because it means that more people will be buying Dreamcasts and, you know, experiencing games that they may have missed out on. But part of me is also a bit apprehensive because it means that sellers are going to see this and then they're going to put the price up artificially of games, you know, and it's mainly based around the UK market at the moment, but who knows, it's going to possibly bleed into the American market and beyond, so... What do you think?
I think the only solid numbers in that entire article were the 20 Dreamcasts that the one store talked about selling. If it's a trend, fine, but like there didn't seem to be that many hard numbers to it. I personally think this won't really affect the U.S. market that much. The Dreamcast, as far as I've seen, you know, it depends on the area. In my particular area, in upstate New York, I've never seen a Dreamcast sell for less than $35 in an independent shop. And basically, you know, I don't think it's going to affect the prices that much. It's already, like, super high for Dreamcast. Dreamcast games are very, very rare unless you live near certain areas. And, you know, the shops that would sell them for cheap are going to continue to sell them for cheap, and the shops that are going to use eBay prices are going to use eBay prices. So, of course, you're going to see an increase in price in stores that use eBay prices for levels, and any Shenmue copies out there that you're seeing on eBay or in those stores are going to go up in price. I don't think it's going to affect the system prices I don't think it's going to affect the availability. I think it's awesome that if more people are playing the Dreamcast, that's great.
It's good for us. I mean, more people will hopefully come to the website and they'll come to the podcast and all that kind of thing. But, I mean, this week alone I saw on eBay, it wasn't even a copy of the game. It was a copy of the Shenmue 2 manual for £20, which I thought was pretty repulsive, to be honest.
It is repulsive, but, like, yeah, I mean, it's what I expect. I mean, maybe Caleb's right that it won't affect... All we can hope is it won't affect the overall, like, financial scene of the Dreamcast, like, overall. I mean, obviously, with the announcement of Shenmue 3, prices with Shenmue and Shenmue 2 are going to go up, and anything related to them is going to go up. And obviously, if you want to play Shenmue 1 and 2, then, okay, I know there was the Xbox. Was it the Xbox version? Yeah, there was the Xbox version. But really, it's the Dreamcast that you want, so there's going to be a knock-on effect. But Dreamcast, in terms of the hardware, are quite... They're not as ten a penny as, say, the PS2, but we all know they're quite available.
The only thing I fear, though, the hardware has been ten a penny. You know, I mean, it's been really cheap. You can pick up, like, a yellowing Dreamcast for, like, a tenner or something. Second-hand shop or wherever. But now it's kind of mythical status has been, like, bequeathed to the system and the series that people want to get involved in. I'm a bit fearful that, you know, it's going to go out of the price range of the average gamer, you know, and be pushed up ridiculously, like things like the Jaguar, you know, which have gone through the roof recently.
I think it's a very well-founded fear, and I can't say that I am not a little bit apprehensive, because I'd be less worried if it hadn't happened in other systems. And I've seen this happen, you know, like with my own eye. I'm sure you guys have as well, with systems over the past 5, 10, 15 years, specifically the last 10 years, you've watched as consoles suddenly came into vogue. It was like suddenly their time, and maybe like the Dreamcast, it's just coming around to its time now. Hopefully the community will grow, but we won't see £20 manuals. You know.
Yeah, I mean, this story was actually reported in the mainstream press in the UK. So, I mean, that really, to me, sounds like the death knell for the cheap Dreamcast console.
I feel like the gaming community and the retro community, they don't really have a firm grasp of supply and demand. So it does make sense that demand is increasing, and so supply is increasing, and prices change to reflect that.
Now, wait a second, though. You are from Australia, and I know in Australia, video games cost hundreds and hundreds of dollars. I've seen the Beat 'Em Ups YouTube channel where the Australian guys run around and they eat at Hungry Jack's and they try to find video games, and they're paying a lot more money than we are.
Which is also related to supply and demand. But it's like, if you buy a Dreamcast now for, say, you know, $80 or something, I think people have an expectation that if they want to sell it 5 years down the track, that they should at least get $80 or potentially, you know, $100, $120 now. But that's not how it works. Things don't always go up. It's dependent on whether people still want to buy it. Like the cost of something is based on what people are willing to pay, not what you're expecting. And I feel like...
Yeah, and the ease of selling it too. Like like the Dreamcast, you could find somebody like a local shop that would take it in, but they're not going to give you a very good price for it at all.
No.
So it's like this artificial eBay bubble that's happening. It really just depends on your area, because it's an artificial price point right now for video games. It just is. It's a seller's market.
It's not sustainable. Like you can imagine a scenario where Radiant Silver Gun is the sort of the poster child for expensive Saturn game, and you sort of expect it like $250, $300 for it. But if every seller advertises it for that price, and not one copy of Radiant Silver Gun is sold for like 10 years or something, and there are sellers that want money, you know, eventually the price will go down if people refuse to pay that price point. But there are always like a handful of people that will commit to that investment, and then expect that if they want to sell it down the track, that they will get that back in the future. But you cannot control prices to that. You cannot have those expectations. Like whenever I sell anything on eBay, you just chuck it on for a dollar and you let people fight over what they think it's worth. You cannot say, well, this is old and rare, so it must be $500 or whatever. It's what people are willing to pay. It's not what you think you should get for it. But that understanding hasn't really filtered through yet. And I don't think it will filter through for a number of years until people start realizing that I can't sell this stuff that I want to sell now because people just aren't interested in. So if buyers get together and say, refuse to pay this much for what you want, then the prices will go down. But it's getting that coordinated sort of groupthink is difficult.
Certainly. And I do want to say one thing real quick to any potential sellers. Now, what Scott just said, 99 cents, that's if you're absolutely sure that the buyers know that it's a value and there's multiple people that want to buy it. Now, for example, I just sold a copy of Shenmue on eBay, and I only got $24 for it. Now, it was missing the manual, and the case was beaten up. But, you know, that's ridiculously low. Now, if I would have been a little bit smarter and done like a whole high price but give me an offer, that's sometimes a better way to go about it. The whole 99 cents thing, that's eBay. That's eBay wants you to do that. If you know if an item has sold recently for a high price, then the 99 cent thing will work. But sometimes the way eBay's system works, you know, sometimes your auctions are a little bit harder to find. So,
yeah, like I agree that, but I would counter argue that the $24 that you got for it was what it was worth because that's what someone was willing to pay for it. Like it's even though you have a concept that others have sold for more, that may not apply. Like the pool of people that wanted to buy the game may not have wanted to spend any more than $24. So there's sort of the conceptual idea.
My point being is like, you know, I only got a free listing for 7 days. During that 7 days, $24 was the most somebody wanted to pay for it.
Yeah.
But if I had listed an item like that for a buy it now and listed it over like, you know, 20 days, then I'm sure I could have gotten much more than that. As it stood now, I don't really give a crap about getting the maximum amount of money. I just want to say, you know, just do a little research, people, because the whole 99 cent thing sometimes isn't the best way to sell items, even if they do have a significant value. You just have to use eBay and like come up with your own thing. Don't let me talk about eBay. I'll talk about eBay all the time.
Shut that down. We've talked enough about that, guys. Okay, so moving on. Recently on the Junkyard, Tom put together a really nice little piece about just this really interesting little sort of snapshot story related to Jet Set Radio, the Dreamcast, and Milwaukee. Tom, do you want to run through this? Because this was sort of like your baby.
Basically, I was just reading through some of my old Dreamcast magazines, and I came across a little passage in one of the news pages. It was only about 20 lines, and it was just a little thing about the city of Milwaukee in Wisconsin had petitioned Sega to ban the sale of Jet Set Radio. So I went online and I had a look around, and there was a couple of articles from like around 2000. There was one on Spong.com, a couple of articles on a few forums, which were from like, you know, from the period like 2000. And so I did a little bit of digging into the city of Milwaukee's common council, it's known as, which is like the governance of the city. And I found the minutes of the actual meeting that took place within the common council, where the members of the common council decided that this new game that was coming out was a threat to the city itself, because they had like a bit of an issue with graffiti up until this point, like through the 90s and into the early 2000s. And so they actually voted to petition Sega to get the game banned. Now, whether or not that was to get the game banned in Milwaukee or the entire United States, it's not made clear, but I just thought it was a really nice story, and the way that they kind of banded together to send an email to the head of Sega at the time and say, look, we don't want this game because it's going to, you know, it's our impressionable youth of Milwaukee might go out and start tagging buses and trains and other urban furniture because they've been playing Jet Set Radio on the Dreamcast. I just thought it was a really nice snapshot of the early 2000s and the naivety of government, really.
And the hubris of like, we can force you not to do this.
You got to understand, too, what type of people end up on common councils in the United States.
I mean, is common council, is that phrase, does that mean something to Caleb?
Yeah, the city that I'm in right now has a common council. It's, you know, it's an interesting, you know, I don't even want to get into it. Let's just say it probably went down like this. Video games are bad. Our impressionable youth just do what they see in those video games. And they're going to be rollerblading and they're going to be painting all the walls.
That's, yeah. Nice. One quote that I found interesting from the story was that the spokesman for Sega at the time was a lady called Gwendolyn Marker. And she basically responded saying, basically, we have no plans to stop publishing Jet Grind Radio, and that it's a fantasy, and that it celebrates graffiti as art. And I just think that was really, like, succinctly put, you know.
Yeah, it's phrased incredibly sort of, like, PR-friendly, but basically it's a massive middle finger, isn't it? It's a massive great big middle finger and a stone wall going, it's a business. We're selling a product. F you, basically.
Exactly, and yeah.
I'm not saying that the free market should be able to run riot and you should be able to sell anything you want, but come on.
Yeah, I reckon it's interesting.
I find it fascinating. The story, sorry, Scott, I mean, the story is fascinating just because this was like a little article that I read in this magazine, and then I looked a bit deeper and discovered that it was actually true, and then looked even deeper, actually found the minutes of the meeting on their own website. Yeah, I mean, government agencies are obliged legally, certainly in this country, so I assumed it was the same in the US, to keep records of all their kind of public meetings, you know. And just the way that, you know, the 17 members of this Common Council who all voted, like, in favour of, you know, applying for a ban on this game, and that Sega had basically just said, well, we don't really give a fuck, you know, we're going to release it anyway, so...
Yeah.
I thought, like, I'd forgotten about this, and you writing the article sort of reminded me of it, and I sort of try and imagine alternative scenarios of how things would have gone down, like, if it was, like, a large, like a state or federal sort of issue that sort of... it was petitioned at, you know, Congress or whatever at the you know, the federal level, like whether how that would have played out if it wasn't just, you know, one particular district. And then
you already know how it played out. You're in Australia where like for a long time, like, you had to be like over the age to buy like any video game, and like pretty much any video game was listed as adult only, and you know, a lot of, you know, I mean, you're living in how it would end up, really.
That is true. I've always played old games where this didn't apply, but yeah, I've sort of been aware of it. But yeah, I think, and then coming at it from the perspective, if Jet Set Radio was a horrible, terrible game that everybody hated, and would we have sided with Sega, or would we have sided with Milwaukee? Because it is such a fantastic game, we sort of laugh it off and go, haha, look at those naive, you know, councilmen and stuff. But if the game was terrible, would our perspective change on this situation? And I'm not sure whether it would, but because it is such a good game, you sort of it makes it's all the more ironic and funny. But, you know, if the game was different, I wonder how, you know, perspectives would change.
I can totally see what their the aim was of this campaign, because, like I say, they did have a problem. It's well documented that they had a problem with graffiti, and they didn't want people playing this game and then going and thinking, oh, it's cool to, like, you know, spread graffiti on walls and whatnot. But again, going back to what you said earlier, I think they thought that their objection to the release of the game would have spread to other cities in the area.
Yeah,
I mean, there's some pretty big conurbations around that part of the world, and the fact that nobody else kind of joined forces with them, I think, is like a bit of a smack in the face. Yeah.
The idea is too is, like, this whole attitude's all come from the time in the 90s when people started coming out against, like, you know, Mortal Kombat And of course, the other video game was the Sega CD
Night Trap.
No, I forgot what the
Night,
title was.
Night Trap. Yeah.
Yes. And it, and Night Trap. You're asking, well, what if it was a terrible game? Night Trap was a terrible game.
Yeah, that's
was,
true.
Nobody, and even if it was a terrible game, people still kind of saw. The majority of the people kind of saw, like, well, this is kind of silly that they're. This is obviously a campy, you know, horror game. It's. You know, it's clearly, you know, so not really anything happened from that other than, you know, we have this huge population in the United States that still is suspect of video games even to this day. And I think, you know, that attitude is kind of carried on, certainly, into other negative attitudes people have against video games in the United States. It, but, you know, other countries have that same thing, too, just to a lesser degree. I think this was a situation where somebody had too much time on their hands and they wanted to raise a stink about something. That's what I think.
Okay, we'll move on, guys. Okay, next we're just going to talk about a upcoming new release on the Dreamcast. This is one of the best things about the Dreamcast. We're still getting games released on it. And the next one's coming is Hughcast Ghostblade. Gentlemen, what do we think?
I think it looks fantastic, and I think it's got a really good soundtrack as well. They released a launch trailer a few days ago, and it just looks great. You know, you've got different difficulty levels. You've got two player mode. You've got the frantic gameplay, but it's, I wouldn't describe it as bullet hell, though. You know, it doesn't look like bullet hell. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it, to be honest. It looks...
Yeah, me too.
Hughcast have had a lot of, like, vitriol directed at them in the past because of, like, promises they've made about other releases, and then the whole there was a bit of a controversy about you know, not sending games to, like, other parts of the world that were outside Europe, I believe.
Yeah, that didn't last long.
No, exactly, yeah. But I think this one looks like the real deal. It's got VGA support, you know, and it's 420p. Well, it sounds amazing from the video I've seen.
Hopefully. I was just going to say, just to play devil's advocate, I've absorbed, you know, I was a huge fan of Hughcast, but yeah, certainly over the past 6 months or so, I've absorbed quite a lot of this criticism and all the criticism that was leveled at them. Is this, with Ghostblade, do we think they have to answer some critics with Ghostblade? You know, I mean, do people think it's fair that they've been sort of getting a bit of a free pass with their releases? Is this a game that needs to really come out and hit home, you know, like a home run, basically, to silence the critics?
Yeah, I mean, we're not going to beat around the bush here. I mean, even though I'm quite friendly with Rene on social media and things, I think that this is the game that needs to be, you know, the one that says, this is what we can do, basically. I know that there's another game coming in the future, which is Redux 2. And, I mean, the initial Redux really rubbed a lot of people up the wrong way. And that's why I asked the questions in the interview about how a lot of people felt a bit sort of misled by the claims that they put out about other games in the past. But going back to the Ghostblade, I think that this could be, you know, the one that makes people go, yeah, these guys can really, you know, take control of the Dreamcast hardware and shows what they can do, you know, I mean...
Yeah, I'd like people to sort of put things in a bit of perspective as well, because, like, I can understand some of the frustrations and the criticisms that have been directed at Hughcast, but just to put it in perspective, like, we don't want to alienate people that are, like, putting effort into putting games on the Dreamcast by criticizing, you know, mistakes. And when you look at modern games that are released incomplete and various online patches have to be downloaded to correct errors that weren't picked up prior to the master disc, like, we don't have that freedom with the Dreamcast. So it is something that, you know, potentially does happen occasionally and shouldn't cause such a outcry as it did. At least from my perspective, I feel like level heads should be at play, and, you know, and, like, appreciate the fact that, they're still making the effort rather than criticizing them for every mistake that happens. Well, that's how I feel about it anyway.
That's a good point. I mean, I think retro gamers as a whole are quite hard to please kind of bunch. You know, I don't know if I'm kind of putting my neck out there. But people are releasing games for the Dreamcast. It's 2015.
Exactly.
Do you know what I mean? These games are still coming out and they look really good.
Yeah.
So let's not, you know, beat them up on certain things that they may be said that would be included and aren't because of time restrictions or whatever it is.
That's
still
right.
Putting games out fully boxed, professional games with, you know, unique soundtracks and great looking.
Like even some of the criticism that's been leveled at the Alan Saar Filia release, like, it was released at a sort of reasonably budget price point, and you know, it is just a port of some Jaguar CD games that people might already own if they have a Jaguar CD. But, you know, the fact that they're even looking beyond the shoot 'em up genre and, you know, putting that option out there, you mm-hmm. know, I thought was commendable. But then you see people, oh, that game looks horrible, I don't like that style of game. And it's like, well, you know, fair enough. It may not be your cup of tea, but, you know, you should at least have an appreciation for the fact that other people might like to play games like that. And there's, you know, the effort of actually doing it was, you know, commendable as far as I could tell. But
yeah, I mean, Scott, I think that you're slightly biased because you paid $2,000 for a copy of Myst. But
in my defense, that was more of a digital preservation perspective rather than the fact that I loved Myst.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was for the benefit of mankind. It wasn't for just for me.
Oh, God.
Again, coming towards the end, guys, but before we get there, we need to promote the third part of our amazing Dreamcast Junkyard comp for these amazing Dreamcast LPs, which no doubt you've seen already. And if you haven't, go to the Dreamcast Junkyard website and take a look. It's in down the right bar. You can enter the 10th anniversary competition. The third part is a Sega Rally Fast Lap Challenge, and we've had quite a lot of entries on this one. This one's been really popular, probably because it's Sega Rally and it's loads of fun. Tom, sorry, how many days have we got left now? Not many.
No, the competition closes on the 7th of September. Basically, what you have to do is you've got to do a fastest lap on the SS1. That's the first stage on Sega Rally. And the car is the
Toyota.
Yeah, the Celica GT4. Yeah, you can use whatever settings you want, but basically you've just got to get the fastest time. Take a picture of your lap time, send it into admin at the Dreamcast Junkyard, and fastest time wins, basically. It's open around the world, wherever you are. Please send your times in. We've got some really good times. I tried my luck the other day again. First time I tried it, I could only get like 59 seconds, which I thought was pretty poor, to be honest. And then I tried again and just like really sat there and went round and round and round and round. I managed to get down to 56 seconds. And, some of the times that have been sent in are at least 5 seconds faster than that, and I have no idea how, but makes me feel very insignificant on the rally front, to be honest.
Awesome.
Better get your magnifying glasses out on the final screenshots and make sure there's no cheaters out there, you know, doing some photoshopping of the
times. I'm looking at individual like pixels on the CRT, you know, see, oh wait a minute, that's a bit dodgy, that's a different color, that
high def photos.
Okay, and that brings us on, gentlemen, to the last major part of today's podcast, which is our retro review. On launch, IGN gave Echo the Dolphin, Defender of the Future, 7.6 out of 10, stating, Sega's return to Echo is beautiful, but just a bit fishy. Was IGN right or not? Gentlemen!
No.
No! Scott, lead on.
I think a lot of the press at the time unfairly focused too much on it being a very pretty and very graphically nice game, which is true. It was very beautiful, and they even used National Geographic photos to establish some of the textures of the game world, which is why it looks so great. But there was a lot of criticism of the gameplay and the difficulty, and it was too hard or hard to get your head around. And I think it's because when you approach a third-person, three-dimensional sort of adventure platformer slash game, the standard gamer's toolkit is that you're a body that is grounded to a surface level, and you can like push a block into a wall and climb up on the block to get to the higher ledge, And in an Echo game, that doesn't apply because you just swim to the higher ledge. So a lot of the gameplay mechanics of how you attack the game, the things that you've learned from other games no longer apply because it's just a different world and a different experience. And it's one of my, you know, most treasured gaming experiences. Like the entire Echo franchise, I think, is just brilliant. And once you get past that hurdle of, to paraphrase, you know, a famous pet detective, to, you know, to play as the dolphin, you must think like the dolphin, you must get inside the dolphin's head. And like a lot of the puzzles in the game are sort of have to be, like the developer had to create puzzles that were from the dolphin's perspective, not from, you know, a grounded walking around perspective. And it's kind of similar to the cult classic on PC, the Descent games that were sort of a spoof of the Doom games, but because you were your frame of reference was constantly changing depending on which way, you know, your nose was facing. Like that's a similar experience in Echo the Dolphin. And I believe at the time when the game was reviewed, you know, in like, I don't know what the deadlines were, like a month span or, you know, several weeks span before the next magazine issue was released. I'm not sure whether many reviewers sort of got past that hurdle, but once you get past that hurdle, I think it's a fantastic game.
I think I agree with you. I think you're right, Descent. I hadn't actually thought about that. I was thinking, when I first played Echo, I thought it was like, this is like Nights into Dreams. It had that same sort of weird floaty detachment to it. And I think it was because the programmers were really struggling to, as you say, to create this world where all those physical rules of previous video games suddenly don't apply because you're underwater all the time and you can be orientated in any direction, just like Descent. And you can get very, I can remember when I started playing it, feeling very sort of not woozy, but I struggled to keep up with, like, where am I? What, which way am I facing? Up, down, left, right? And things just didn't quite feel right. But I think I agree with you that you had to get over a hurdle. I think that's a great way to describe it. And I think as soon as you got used to it, then the sensation of speed and the freedom you got to be able to move through that space was really refreshing and something that was, for the time, which is, I think this is 2000 Echo on the Dreamcast, was pretty unique.
I'll jump in here and say that I wasn't actually a big fan of the game. I remember the originals on the Saturn and the Mega CD. The Mega Drive and the Mega CD. But, I remember playing it initially and being wowed by the visuals and thinking it looked really, really good. It still looks amazing now, you know, I mean, the way you can kind of, like, make Echo do that, like, sort of backward swimming thing on the surface and, like, look around just look how amazing. Because, like, the world is not covered in fog, you know. When you get up to the surface, it's, you know, really clear and you can see for miles.
I just, sorry to butt into, I love when you can sort of, when you jump out of the water at speed and then go back under. As you say, there was no fog, no clipping. It was great. Sorry, continue.
No, I was basically going to say that, I mean, all the things you've just described there about, you know, having a frame of reference for other types of games where you could, like, be, like, roaming around. The one game that springs to mind for me was, like, Soul Reaver. You were always, like, on a level where you could, like, push blocks into holes and climb up on ledges. The very fact that it was all kind of three-dimensional is probably what made it not very appealing to me. And not just that, but I also found myself getting lost.
Quite
a lot, you know. I know you had your sonar, and there are points in the game where you get told where you need to go, but I just found myself getting like completely lost. What I'm meant to do, I don't understand what the story is. It's too hard. There was a bit where you had to do some, like, very early on in the game, you had to do some, like, races against some sharks or some other dolphin, and I was just like, I'm done. You know, it wasn't a game that I enjoyed personally, but I can see the appeal once you get into it, because I did actually read the guide. Weirdly, I went through the guidebook that was issued for the game, and later on in the game, there's some really impressive stages. I knew I was never going to get there because I just didn't have the patience. But I thought I'll have a look and see where it goes, and then thinking, yeah, maybe I should have given it a bit more time because it does actually get quite good later on, but I knew I'd never get there myself.
Yeah, there's like four main chapters, and I reckon the second and the third chapter are brilliant. Like the first chapter is okay, but I reckon the second chapter and the third chapter are fantastic. The fourth chapter is a bit of a. I think it's a common curse with a lot of Echo games that the final stages can be a bit disappointing, but those middle two sections are absolutely brilliant. And if you're listening out there and you've never played it before, I recommend that you don't read any guides, just go into it and persevere, because it gets really good and it's really satisfying. That like, you will get stuck in not knowing what to do, and some of the puzzles are very tricky, but once you know, you just turn it off and walk away for a few weeks and think about it. And once it clicks and once you figure it out, it's really satisfying. Like the second chapter through the bad future of the dolphins' bad future, where they're forced to work in an underground diamond mine and you have to work your way to the center of the diamond mine. Like that entire chapter of the game is absolutely brilliant. And the way you solve the puzzles of getting there is... It's like I cannot stress how much I love this game, and I think a lot of people didn't quite get that far. And I have heard that the PlayStation 2 version did correct a lot of these issues about not being signposted enough about what to do next. Yes. So perhaps this is an issue I'd like to cover in future sort of game reviews, that. Even though I prefer the Dreamcast version and I prefer the Dreamcast aesthetics of how it filters the pixels better than what I think it does in the PlayStation 2 version, I think if you're coming to it from a perspective that if you own both the Dreamcast and a PlayStation 2, you could potentially consider the PlayStation 2 version, because it does also feature an additional area and gallery that isn't present in the Dreamcast version. So there's some additional features in this other version. So it's a toss-up about which version is preferable. I personally prefer the Dreamcast version, but it may be more yours, maybe suited to someone else might be more suited to the PlayStation 2 version.
I mean, it does have a very interesting story. I know that the it's to do with like all the fish get taken out of the ocean or something, or all the humans get taken away, or
I get it. I should have done more research, because I've played like all of the games, and I remember back in the day with the original Mega Drive version, I made the mistake of getting a, like, this is pre-internet, you know, getting a guide and getting a list of the passwords of all the levels and going straight to the final level. And I think this is probably common of a lot of people that played the first game. When you jump from the first level to the final level, there's such a large disconnect between, you go, what the hell is going on in the final level? Just the storyline, like I'm sort of tempted to do spoilers, but storyline just goes into this weird, you know, like science fiction Geiger style alien invasion thing that you don't really expect from, you know, the box art and the first initial levels.
Yeah. That's initially what kind of drew me to it. You know, when I read the reviews and found out that it was kind of like a sort of a mass extinction storyline, I was like, I quite like that. And then when I played it, I was just like, this is not, I'm not really getting into the story. I'm racing around rocks with other dolphins, and I'm just like, it's not really getting me into the story. So I kind of just abandoned it. But maybe after like listening to speaking to you and talking about it, I might try and get back into it.
Yeah, there's an interesting sort of legacy there with the first two games and the Mega Drive, Mega CD have a sort of continuous storyline that is analogous to Shenmue 3, in that, you know, the second game ends on such a somber, disappointing, you know, bad note that there was an expectation of a third game to complete the 16-bit trilogy. So hashtag save Echo 3. But we never got that final, or that continuation of that original story. And then Defender of the Future came out on Dreamcast, which is a reboot and doesn't include some of the characters and locations of the first two games. So there's in the Echo community, there's a little bit of disappointment that the original storyline was never complete, and now I've got a brand new storyline that's a little bit different, and it wasn't written by the original creators, because they were no longer at Appaloosa/Novatrade at the time. It was the storyline was written by David Brin, who's a science fiction author I'm not familiar with, but it was sort of outsourced. and they exist independently, and they're both good in their own ways, but there can be a little bit of disappointment in the disconnect between them. But if you just treat it as an isolated game, it's fine. And I'd like to mention that this is a sentence that has probably never been uttered, but Tom Baker ruined my childhood. Tom Baker does the narration of Defender of the Future, and he introduced me to the fact that Echo's name is pronounced Echo, whereas all through my childhood I'd been pronouncing it Eco. And
Eco.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
So Tom Baker pointed out how wrong my childhood had been, and it was all his fault.
I'm sure he's ruined a bunch of childhoods. Don't worry about it.
I think it's funny that Echo is one of them games that it's one of those like stablemates of the Sega, you know, but yeah. People can generally forget that it was actually released on the Dreamcast. I mean, I certainly always forget that it's until people like mention it like in this podcast.
Even it's confirmed in this podcast. I find a lot of people's experience with Echo are only the first initial stages, like especially in the Dreamcast version and also in the 16-bit versions, that people don't get very far into it, or if they do, they're using cheats or passwords or something, and there's very few people that have committed to getting through that hurdle and the difficulty of changing the way you approach a game, which is, you know, in my mind, makes the game all the better for it, because it's such a unique, even to this day, it's still a unique experience. And I was supremely disappointed that all of the people that get on Kickstarter and support Shenmue 3 and the next Castlevania and the next Mega Man and you know, nobody got behind, and I'm going to pronounce his name wrong and I'm sorry, it's Ed Annunziata, I don't know how to pronounce his last name, but Ed, who was one of the original co-creators of Echo, was interested in getting the license to create Echo 3, and he also did a Kickstarter for a non-Echo licensed game called The Big Blue, which looked fantastic. It was like a MMORPG version of an Echo-style universe where everyone is, you know, an aquatic creature in a giant ocean, and there's like an alien force developed from the plastic that has circulated, that giant plastic island of rubbish in the middle of the Pacific where currents have like put it all together, like thousands of years in the future. He thinks that the long carbon chains of the plastic evolve into life forms that are attacking the naturally sort of evolved aquatic creatures, and there's this giant storyline of like a war between, you know, the dolphin kind and these, you know, plastic. You know, and that sounded absolutely fantastic to me, and it didn't get off Kickstarter, and it didn't get enough support, and everyone is a terrible person for not supporting it, and I'm very disappointed.
That's such a sad note. We can't end on such a sad note.
I give Eco the Dolphin Defender of the Future. It's got great fish-eating mechanics. Eat good fish, don't eat bad fish, but sometimes you will need to eat the bad fish. I give the game 8 out of 10. That's 8 out of 10.
Do you wait for IGN?
You sound like you do. Okay, Jack, that's it then. Last things. Come on, right, Scott.
Hey, Tom. Tom?
Yeah.
Tom? No. No. Don't make jokes like that. Don't make jokes, and I know you did it before. I'm going to tell you, don't say that I love hentai games on the internet when that's not true. And don't make jokes like that. Don't do it.
Okay.
All right.
So, Scott, Echo the Dolphin, how many out of 10?
11 out of 10. 10 out of 10.
11 out of 10.
It's one of my most favorite games.
Tom, how many out of 10? Come on.
You can't rate it until you've played it to the end. You've got to play it till the end, and then you can rate it. You can't rate it unless you've completed it. Yeah.
Two for graphic.
Out of what?
Caleb's give it...
Apparently I can't rate it because I've not finished it.
Caleb's given the IGN score out of 10.
Caleb gives it Kotaku out of 10.
Kotaku out of 10, yeah. Okay. Kotaku? Okay, right, so let's go. That's it, gents. Before I shut this down, is there anything else anyone wants to mention? Speak now or forever hold your peace. Good, super. Okay. So that was episode 13 of the Dreamcast Junkyard Dream Pod. If you want to get into the Dreamcast scene, or just if you're already in it and want to know more about the Dreamcast, or want to check out past podcasts, then you can do that at the Dreamcast Junkyard website. That's www.thedreamcastjunkyard.co.uk. Also, we have a Facebook page, which is facebook.com/thedreamcastjunkyard. You can contact the Dreamcast Junkyard at admin@thedreamcastjunkyard.co.uk or through the Dreamcast Junkyard's official Twitter account, which is @SegaJunkyard. Equally, you can contact any of the team members that you've heard today and others who weren't on the pod. They've all got their individual Twitter accounts. And Tom, you are on Twitter at
Tom Lee C.
Scott, you're on Twitter at
@Doc_EggFan with an F.
Super. And Caleb, we know you're on Twitter, but you've got to find Caleb, right?
Yeah, you know what? It's Twitter's weird, man. I just started using it again. I randomly was talking about the movie Turbo Kid, that movie that looks like a college student project, but with like horrific, gory effects. And the producer of the movie, like, he favorited my tweet, and it's like, wow. So I guess this is why people like Twitter. This is really strange.
I've been getting lots of attractive girls following me, and I'm thinking this must be some kind of scam because I don't know where
they're not real.
From.
They're not real.
They mustn't
well,
be.
They're not real.
Are you saying there are attractive girls in your neighborhood?
I they seem to be outside of Australia, but they're following me on Twitter. So thanks for that, but I don't know who you are and why you're following me, but that's nice.
They're not real.
No. Beware attractive girls on Twitter, because, yes, 99% out of 100, they're not real, specifically in gaming and retro gaming circles.
Yeah, yeah. I was suspicious. I'm new to Twitter myself, so it's like, who are all these people?
Yeah, if someone called gamer_girl8 or something follows you, then it's guaranteed not to be real.
Yeah.
Okay, and lastly, I'm also on Twitter, your host, at rnicholasj. That's rnicholasj. That was it. That was episode 13 of the Dreamcast Junkyard Dream Pod. Say goodbye, everybody. Bye.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Please stop this disc now.